though some were as shallow as 40 or 50 feet, many were well over 100 feet deep. Sills zipped away to lead Rock and his crew, and Kaladin moved back to the main body of bridgemen to help Teft correct stances. It was difficult work. The first day always was. The bridgemen were sloppy and uncertain. But they also showed remarkable resolve. Kaladin had never worked with a group who made fewer complaints. The bridgemen didn't ask for a break. They didn't shoot him resentful glances when he pushed them harder. The scowls they bore were at their own foibles, angry at themselves for not learning faster. And they got it. After just a few hours, the more talented of them, Moash at the forefront, started to change into fighting men. Their stances grew firmer, more confident. When they should have been feeling exhausted and frustrated, they were more determined. Kaladin stepped back, watching Moash fall into his stance after Teft shoved him. It was a resetting exercise. Moash would let Teft knock him backward, then would scramble back and set his feet, time and time again. The purpose was to train oneself to revert to the stance without thinking. Kaladin normally wouldn't have started resetting exercises until the second or third day. Yet here Moash was drinking it in after only 2 hours. There were two others, Dre and Scar, who were nearly as quick to learn. Kaladin leaned back against the stone wall. Cold water leaked down the rock beside him, and a frill bloom plant hesitantly opened its fan-like fronds beside his head, two wide orange leaves with spines on the tips, unfolding like opening fists. Is it their bridgeman training? Kaladin wondered. Or is it their passion? He had given them a chance to fight back. That kind of opportunity changed a man. Watching them stand resolute and capable in stances they had only been just taught, Kaladin realized something. These men, cast off by the army, forced to work themselves near to death, then fed extra food by Kaladin's careful planning, were the most fit, training-ready recruits he'd ever been given. By seeking to beat them down, Sarius had prepared them to excel.
Backbreaker powder. Flame and char, skin so terrible, eyes like pits of blackness. A quote from the Iviad probably needs no reference notation, but this comes from line 482, should I need to locate it quickly. Shallan awoke in a small white room. She sat up, feeling oddly healthy. Bright sunlight illuminated the window's gossamer white shades, bursting through the cloth and into the room. Shallan frowned, shaking her muddled head. She felt as if she should be burned toes to ears, her skin flaking off. But that was just a memory. She had the cut on her arm, but otherwise she felt perfectly well. A rustling sound. She turned to see a nurse hurrying away down a white hallway outside. The woman had apparently seen Shallan sit up, and was now taking the news to someone. "I'm in the hospital," Shallan thought. "Move to a private room." A soldier peeked in, inspecting Shallan. It was apparently a guarded room. "What happened?" she called to him. "I was poisoned, wasn't I?" She felt a sudden shock of alarm. "Capsule, is he all right?" The guard just turned back to his post. Shallan began to crawl out of bed, but he looked in again, glaring at her. She yelped despite herself, pulling up the sheet and settling back. She still wore one of the hospital robes, much like a soft bathing robe. How long had she been unconscious? Why was she... "The soul caster," she realized. "I gave it back to Yasna." The next half hour was one of the most miserable in Shallan's life. She spent it suffering the periodic glares of the guard and feeling nauseated. What had happened? Finally, Yasna appeared at the other end of the hallway. She was wearing a different dress, black with light gray piping. She strode toward the room like an arrow and dismissed the guard with a single word as she passed. The man hurried away, his boots louder on the stone floor than Yasna's slippers. Yasna came in, and though she made no accusations, her glare was so hostile that Shallan wanted to crawl under her covers and hide. No, she wanted to crawl under the bed, dig down into the floor itself, and put stone between herself and those eyes. She settled for looking downward in shame.
"You were wise to return the soul caster," Yasna said, voice like ice. "It saved your life. I saved your life."
"Thank you," Shallan whispered.
"Who are you working with? Which devotary bribed you to steal the Fabriel?"
"None of them, Brightness. I stole it of my own volition."
"Protecting them does you no good. Eventually you will tell me the truth."
"It is the truth," Shallan said, looking up, feeling a hint of defiance. "It's why I became your ward in the first place. To steal that soul caster."
"Yes, but for whom?"
"For me," Shallan said. "Is it so hard to believe that I could act for myself? Am I such a miserable failure that the only rational answer is to assume I was duped or manipulated?"
"You have no grounds to raise your voice to me, child," Yasna said evenly. "And you have every reason to remember your place."
Shallan looked down again.
Yasna was silent for a time.
Finally, she sighed.
"What were you thinking, child?"
"My father is dead."
"So?"
"He was not well-liked, Brightness. Actually, he was hated, and our family is bankrupt. My brothers are trying to put up a strong front by pretending he still lives, but..."
"Dared she tell Yasna that her father had possessed a soul caster?"
"Doing so wouldn't help excuse what Shallan had done, and might get her family more deeply into trouble. We needed something, an edge, a way to earn money quickly or create money."
Yasna was silent again.
When she finally spoke, she sounded faintly amused.
"You thought your salvation lay in enraging not only all the entire Ardentia, but Alethkar? Do you realize what my brother would have done if he'd learned of this?"
Shallan looked away, feeling both foolish and ashamed. Yasna sighed.
"Sometimes I forget how young you are. I can see how the theft might have looked tempting to you. It was stupid nonetheless. I've arranged passage back to Yarkoved. You will leave in the morning." It was more than she deserved.
"Thank you."
"Your friend, the Ardent, is dead."
Shallan looked up, dismayed. "What happened?"
"The bread was poisoned. Backbreaker powder. Very lethal. Dusted over the bread to look like flour. I suspect the bread was similarly treated every time he visited. His goal was to get me to eat a piece."
"But I ate a lot of that bread."
"The jam had the antidote," Yasna said. "We found it in several empty jars he'd used."
"It can't be."
"I've begun investigating," Yasna said. "I should have done so immediately. Nobody quite remembers where this capsule came from. Though he spoke familiarly of the other Ardents to you and me, they knew him only vaguely."
"Then he..."
"He was playing you, child. The whole time he was using you to get to me, to spy on what I was doing, to kill me if he could."
She spoke of it so evenly, so emotionlessly.
"I believe he used much more of the powder during this last attempt, more than he'd ever used before, perhaps hoping to get me to breathe it in. He realized this would be his last opportunity. It turned against him, however, working more quickly than he'd anticipated."
"Someone had almost killed her."
"Not someone.
Capsule!"
"No wonder he'd been so eager to get her to taste the jam." "I'm very disappointed in you, Shallan," Yasna said. "I can see now why you tried to end your own life. It was the guilt."
She hadn't tried to kill herself. But what good would it do to admit that?
Yasna was taking pity on her.
Best not to give her reason not to. But what of the strange things Shallan had seen and experienced? Might Yasna have an explanation for them? Looking at Yasna, seeing the cold rage hidden behind her calm exterior frightened Shallan enough that her questions about the symbol heads and the strange place she'd visited died on her lips. How had Shallan ever thought of herself as brave? She wasn't brave. She was a fool. She remembered the times her father's rage had echoed through the house. Yasna's quieter, more justified anger was no less daunting. "Well, you will need to learn to live with your guilt," Yasna said. "You might not have escaped with my Fabriel, but you have thrown away a very promising career. This foolish scheme will stain your life for decades. No woman will take you as a ward now. You threw it away." She shook her head in distaste. "I hate being wrong." With that, she turned to leave. Shallan raised a hand. "I have to apologize. I have to say something. Yasna?" The woman did not look back, and the guard did not return. Shallan curled up under the sheet, stomach in knots, feeling so sick that for a moment she wished that she'd actually dug that shard of glass in a little deeper. Or maybe that Yasna hadn't been quick enough with the soul caster to save her. She'd lost it all. No Fabriel to protect her family, no wardship to continue her studies, no capsule. She'd never actually had him in the first place. Her tears dampened the sheets as the sunlight outside faded, then vanished. Nobody came to check on her. Nobody cared.
51. Sasnan. 1 year ago. Kaladin sat quietly in the waiting room of Amaram's wooden war center. It was constructed of a dozen study sections that could be disconnected and pulled by chulls. Kaladin sat beside a window, looking out at the camp. There was a hole where Kaladin's squad had been housed. He could make it out from where he sat. Their tents had been broken down and given to other squads. 4 of his men remained. 4 out of 26. And men called him lucky. Men called him storm-blessed. He'd begun to believe that. "I killed a shard-bearer today," he thought, mind numb. "Like Lannison the Surefooted. And Evid Markmaker. Me. I killed one." And he didn't care. He crossed his arms on the wooden windowsill. There was no glass in the window, and he could feel the breeze. A wind spren flitted from one tent to another. Behind Kaladin, the room had a thick red rug and shields on the walls. There were a number of padded wooden chairs, like the one Kaladin sat in. This was the small waiting chamber of the war center, small yet larger than his entire house back in Hearthstone, the surgery included. "I killed a shard-bearer," he thought again, "and then I gave away the blade and plate." That single event had to be the most monumentally stupid thing anyone in any kingdom in any era had ever done. As a shard-bearer, Kaladin would have been more important than Rishon, more important than Amaram. He'd have been able to go to the Shattered Plains and fight in a real war. No more squabbling over borders. No more petty light-eyed captains belonging to unimportant families, bitter because they'd been left behind. He would never again have had to worry about blisters from boots that didn't fit, dinner slop that tasted of creme, or other soldiers who wanted to pick a fight. He could have been rich. He'd given it all away. Just like that. And still, the mere thought of touching that blade turned his stomach. He didn't want wealth, titles, armies, or even a good meal. He wanted to be able to go back and protect the men who had trusted him. Why had he chased the shard-bearer? He should have run. But no, he'd insisted on charging at a storming shard-bearer. "You protected your High Marshal," he told himself. "You're a hero." But why was Amaram's life worth more than those of his men? Kaladin served Amaram because of the honor he had shown. He let spearmen share his comfort in the war center during high storms, a different squad each storm. He insisted that his men be well-fed and well-paid. He didn't treat them like slime. He did let his subordinates do so, though, and he'd broken his promise to shelter Tian. So did I. So did I. Kaladin's insides were a twisted mess of guilt and sorrow. One thing remained clear, like a bright spot of light on the wall of a dark room. He wanted nothing to do with those shards. He didn't even want to touch them. The door thumped open and Kaladin turned in his chair. Amaram entered, tall, lean, with a square face and long martial coat of deep green. He walked on a crutch. Kaladin eyed the wrappings and splint with a critical eye. I could have done better. He'd also have insisted that the patient remain in bed. Amaram was talking to one of his storm wardens, a middle-aged man with a square beard and robes of deep black. Why Thydakar would risk this, Amaram was saying, speaking in a soft voice. But who else would it be? The ghost bloods grow more bold. We'll need to find out who he was. Do we know anything about him? He was Vaden, Bright Lord, the storm warden said. Nobody I recognize, but I will investigate. Amaram nodded, falling silent. Behind the two, a group of light-eyed officers entered, one of them carrying the shard blade, holding it on a pure white cloth. Behind this group came the four surviving members of Kaladin's squad. Hab, Rish, Alabet, and Korib. Kaladin stood up, feeling exhausted. Amaram remained by the door, arms folded, as two final men entered and closed the door. These last two were also light eyes, but lesser ones. Officers in Amaram's personal guard. Had these been among those who had fled? It was the smart thing to do, Kaladin thought. Smarter than what I did. Amaram leaned on his walking staff, inspecting Kaladin with bright tan eyes. He'd been in conference with his counselors for several hours now, trying to discover who the shardbearer had been.
You did a brave thing today, soldier, Amaram said to Kaladin.
What did you say to that? I wish I'd left you to die, sir. Thank you.
Everyone else fled, including my honor guard.
The two men closest to the door looked down, ashamed.
But you charged in for the attack. Why?
I didn't really think about it, sir. Amaram seemed displeased by the answer.
Your name is Kaladin, is it?
Yes, Bright Lord. From Hearthstone. Remember? Amaram frowned, looking confused. Your cousin Roshon is City Lord there. He sent my brother into the army when you came recruiting. I joined with my brother.
Oh, yes, Amaram said. I believe I remember you.
He didn't ask after Tian.
You still haven't answered my question. Why attack?
It wasn't for the shard blade.
You rejected that.
Yes, sir. To the side, the storm warden raised his eyebrows as if he hadn't believed that Kaladin had turned down the shards. The soldier holding the shard blade kept glancing at it in awe.
Why? Amaram said. Why did you reject it? I have to know.
I don't want it, sir.
Yes, but why?
Because it would make me one of you. Because I can't look at that weapon and not see the faces of the men its wielder slaughtered so offhandedly. Because... I can't really answer that question, sir, Kaladin said, sighing. The storm warden walked over to the room's brazier, shaking his head. He began warming his hands. Look, Kaladin said. Those shards are mine. Well, I said to give them to Korib. He's the highest ranked of my soldiers and the best fighter among them. The other three would understand. Besides, Korib would take care of them, once he was a Light Eyes. Amaram looked at Korib, then nodded to his attendants. One closed the window shutters. The others pulled out swords, then began moving toward the four remaining members of Kaladin's squad. Kaladin yelled, leaping forward, but two of the officers had positioned themselves close to him. One slammed a punch into Kaladin's gut as soon as he started moving. He was so surprised that it connected directly, and he gasped.
No.
He fought off the pain, turning to swing at the man. The man's eyes opened wide as Kaladin's fist connected, throwing him backward. Several other men piled on him. He had no weapons, and he was so tired from the battle that he could barely stay upright. They knocked him to the ground with punches to his side and back. He collapsed to the floor, pained, but still able to watch as the soldiers came at his men. Rhys was cut down first. Kaladin gasped, stretching out a hand, struggling to his knees.
This can't happen. Please, no.
Hab and Alibet had their knives out, but fell quickly, one soldier gutting Hab as two others hacked down Alibet. Alibet's knife thumped as it hit the ground, followed by his arm, then finally his corpse. Cora blasted the longest, backing away, hands held forward. He didn't scream. He seemed to understand. Kaladin's eyes were watering, and soldiers grabbed him from behind, stopping him from helping. Korob fell to his knees and began to beg. One of Amaram's men took him at the neck, nearly severing his head. It was over in seconds.
You bastard,
Kaladin said, gasping against his pain.
You storming bastard!
Kaladin found himself weeping, struggling uselessly at the four men holding him. The blood of the fallen spearmen soaked the boards. They were dead. All of them were dead. Stormfather, all of them. Amaram stepped forward, expression grim. He went down on one knee before Kaladin.
I'm sorry. Bastard!
Kaladin screamed as loud as he could.
I couldn't risk them telling what they saw. This is what must be, soldier. It's for the good of the army. They're going to be told that your squad helped the Shardbearer. You see, the men must believe that I killed him.
You're taking the shards for yourself!
I am trained in the sword, Amaram said, and am accustomed to plate. It will serve Alethkar best if I bear the shards.
You could have asked me for them, storm you!
And when news got around camp, Amaram said grimly, that you'd killed the shard bearer but I had the shards, nobody would believe that you'd given them up of your own free choice. Besides, son, you wouldn't have let me keep them.
Amaram shook his head.
You'd have changed your mind. In a day or two, you'd have wanted the wealth and prestige. Others would convince you of it. You'd have demanded that I return them to you. It took hours to decide, but Restares is right. This is what must be done. For the good of Alethkar.
It's not about Alethkar. It's about you. Stormed, you're supposed to be better than the others.
Tears dripped from Kaladin's chin. Amaram looked guilty suddenly, as if he knew what Kaladin had said was true. He turned away, waving to the Storm Warden. The man turned from the brazier, holding something he'd been heating in the coals. A small branding iron.
It's all an act?
Kaladin asked.
The Honorable Brightlord who cares about his men? Lies? All of it?
This is for my men, Amaram said.
He took the shard blade from the cloth, holding it in his hand. The gemstone at its pommel let out a flash of white light.
You can't begin to understand the weights I carry, Spearman.
Amaram's voice lost some of its calm tone of reason. He sounded defensive.
I can't worry about the lives of a few dark-eyed spearmen when thousands of people may be saved by my decision.
The Storm Warden stepped up to Kaladin, positioning the branding iron. The glyphs reversed read Sasnan, a slave's brand.
You came for me,
Amaram said, limping to the door, stepping around Risha's body.
For saving my life, I spare yours. Five men telling the same story would have been believed, but a single slave will be ignored. The war camp will be told that you didn't try to help your fellows, but you didn't try to stop them either. You fled and were captured by my guard.
Amaram hesitated by the door, resting the blunt edge of the stolen shard blade on his shoulder. The guilt was still there in his eyes, but he grew hard, covering it.
You are being discharged as a deserter and branded as a slave. But you are spared death by my mercy.
He opened the door and walked out. The branding iron fell, searing Kaladin's fate into his skin. He let out a final, ragged scream. The end of Part 3. Interludes. Baxel, Garanid, Zeth. I-7. Baxel. Baxel hastened down the lavish palace corridor, clutching the bulky bag of tools. A sound like a footfall came from behind him, and he jumped, spinning. He didn't see anything. The corridor was empty. A golden carpet lining the floor, mirrors on the walls, arched ceiling inlaid with elaborate mosaics.
"Would you stop that?" Ab said, walking beside him. "Every time you jump, I nearly cuff you one out of surprise."
"I can't help it," Baxel said. "Shouldn't we be doing this at night?"
"Mistress knows what she's doing," Ab said.
Like Baxel, Av was a mooley, with dark skin and hair, but the taller man was far more self-confident. He sauntered down the halls, acting as if they'd been invited, thick-bladed sword slung in a sheath over his shoulder.
"If the Prime Catasix may provide," Baxel thought, "I'd rather Av never have to draw that weapon, thank you."
Their mistress walked ahead of them, the only other person in the hallway. She wasn't a mooley. She didn't even seem Macabaki, though she had dark skin and long, beautiful black hair. She had eyes like a shin, but she was tall and lean like an Alethi. Av thought she was a mixed breed, or so he said when they dared talk about such things. The mistress had good ears, strangely good ears. She stopped at the next intersection. Baxel caught himself glancing over his shoulder again. Av elbowed him, but he couldn't help looking. Yes, the mistress claimed that the palace servants would be busy getting the new guest wing ready, but this was the home of Ashno of Sages himself, one of the richest and holiest of men in all of Emul. He had hundreds of servants. What if one of them walked down this hallway? The two men joined their mistress at the intersection. He forced his eyes forward so he wouldn't keep looking over his shoulder, but then found himself staring at the mistress. It was dangerous being employed by a woman as beautiful as she was, with that long black hair, worn free, hanging down to her waist. She never wore a proper woman's robe, or even a dress or skirt. Always trousers, usually sleek and tight, a thin-bladed sword at her hip. Her eyes were so faintly violet they were almost white. She was amazing, wonderful, intoxicating, overwhelming. Av elbowed him in the ribs again. Baxel jumped, then glared at his cousin, rubbing his belly.
"Baxel," the mistress said, "my tools."
He opened the bag, handing over a folded tool belt. It clinked as she took it, not looking at him, then she strode down the hallway to their left. Baxel watched, uncomfortable. This was the Hallowed Hall, the place where a wealthy man placed images of his catasix for reverence. The mistress walked up to the first piece of art. The painting depicted Ipan, Lady of Dreams. It was beautiful, a masterpiece of gold leaf on black canvas. The mistress took a knife from her bundle and slashed the painting down the front. Baxel cringed, but said nothing. He'd almost gotten used to the casual way she destroyed art, though he was baffled by it. She did pay the two of them very well, however. Av leaned back against the wall, picking his teeth with a fingernail. Baxel tried to imitate his relaxed pose. The large hallway was lit with topaz chips set in beautiful chandeliers, but they made no move to take them. The mistress did not approve of stealing.
"I've been thinking of seeking the old magic,"
Axel said, partially to keep himself from cringing as the mistress moved on to gouge out the eyes of a fine bust. Ab snorted.
Why?
I don't know, Baxel said. Seems like something to do with myself. I've never sought it, you know, and they say every man gets one chance. Ask a boon of the Night Watcher. Have you used yours?
Nah, Ab said. Don't fancy making the trip all the way to the valley. Besides, my brother went. Came back with two numb hands. Never could feel anything with them again.
What was his boon? Baxel asked, as the mistress wrapped up a vase with a cloth, then quietly shattered it on the floor and crushed the pieces.
Don't know, Ab said. He never said. Seemed embarrassed. Probably asked for something silly, like a good haircut. Ab smirked.
I was thinking I'd make myself more useful, Baxel said. Ask for courage, you know?
If you want, Ab replied. I figure there are better ways than the old magic. You never know what kind of curse you'll end up with.
I could phrase my request perfectly, Baxel said.
Doesn't work that way, Ab said. It's not a game, no matter how the stories try to put it. The Night Watcher doesn't trick you or twist your words. You ask a boon, she gives what she feels you deserve, then gives you a curse to go along with it. Sometimes related, sometimes not.
And you're an expert? Baxel asked. The mistress was slashing another painting.
I thought you said you never went. I didn't, Ab said. On account of my father going, my mother going, and each of my brothers going. A few got what they wanted. Most all of them regretted the curse, save my father. He got a heap of good cloth, sold to keep us from starving during the Lernip famine a few decades ago.
What was his curse? Baxel said.
Saw the world upside down from then on.
Really?
Yeah, Ab said. Twisted all about, like people walk on the ceilings and the sky was underneath him. Said he got used to it pretty quickly, though, and didn't really think it a curse by the time he died.
Even thinking about that curse made Baxel feel sick. He looked down at his sack of tools. If he weren't such a coward, would he, maybe, be able to convince the mistress to see him as something more than just hired muscle? If the Prime Catasix could provide, he thought, it would be very nice if I could know the right thing to do, thank you. The mistress returned, hair somewhat disheveled. She held out a hand.
Padded mallet, Baxel? There's a full statue back there.
He responded, pulling the mallet out of the sack and handing it to her.
Perhaps I should get myself a shard blade, she said absently, putting the tool up on her shoulder. But that might make this too easy.
I wouldn't mind it if it were too easy, mistress, Baxel noted.
She sniffed, walking back down the hallway. Soon she began to pound on a statue at the far end, breaking off its arms. Baxel winced.
Someone's going to hear that.
Yeah, Ab said. Probably why she waited to do it last.
At least the pounding was muffled by the padding. They had to be the only thieves who sneaked into the houses of rich men without taking anything.
Why does she do this, Ab?
Baxel found himself asking.
Don't know. Maybe you should ask her.
I thought you said I should never do that.
Depends, Ab said. How attached to your limbs are you?
Rather attached.
Well, if you ever want that changed, start asking the mistress prying questions. Until then, shut up.
Baxel said nothing further. The old magic, he thought. It could change me. I will go looking for it. Knowing his luck, though, he wouldn't be able to find it. He sighed, resting back against the wall as muted thuds continued to come from the mistress's direction.
I-8 Garanid. I'm thinking of changing my calling, Ashir said from behind. Garanet nodded absently as she worked on her equations. The small stone room smelled sharply of spices. Ashir was trying another new experiment. It involved some kind of curry powder and a rare shin fruit that he'd caramelized. Something like that. She could hear it sizzling on his new fabrial hot plate. "I'm tired of cooking," Ashir continued. He had a soft, kindly voice. She loved him for that. Partially because he liked to talk, and if you were going to have someone talk while you were attempting to think, they might as well have a soft, kindly voice. "I don't have a passion for it as I once did," he continued. "Besides, what good will a cook be in the spiritual realm?" "Heralds need food," she said absently, scratching out a line on her writing board, then scribbling another line of numbers beneath it. "Do they?" Ashir asked. "I've never been convinced. Oh, I've read the speculations, but it just doesn't seem rational to me. The body must be fed in the physical realm, but the spirit exists in a completely different state." "A state of ideals," she replied. "So, you could create ideal foods, perhaps." "What would be the fun in that? No experimentation." "I could do without," she said, leaning forward to inspect the room's hearth, where two flamespren danced on the log's fire. "If it meant never again having to eat something like that green soup you made last month." "Ah," he said, sounding wistful. "That was something, wasn't it? Completely revolting, yet made entirely from appetizing ingredients." He seemed to consider it a personal triumph. "I wonder if they eat in the cognitive realm. Is a food there what it sees itself as being? I'll have to read and see if anyone has ever eaten while visiting Shadesmar." Garanid responded with a non-committal grunt, getting out her calipers and leaning closer to the heat to measure the flamespren. She frowned, then made another notation. "Here, love," Ashir said, walking over, then knelt beside her and offered a small bowl. "Give this a try. I think you'll like it." She eyed the contents. Bits of bread covered with a red sauce. It was men's food, but they were both Ardens, so that didn't matter. From outside came the sounds of waves gently lapping against the rocks. They were on a tiny reshi island, technically sent to provide for the religious needs of any Voran visitors. Some travelers did come to them for that, occasionally even some of the reshi. But really this was a way of getting away and focusing on their experiments. Garanid with her spren studies, Ashir with his chemistry, through cooking, of course, as it allowed him to eat the results. The portly man smiled affably, head shaven, gray beard neatly squared off. They both kept to the rules of their stations, despite their seclusion. One did not write the ending of a lifetime of faith with a sloppy last chapter. "No green," she noted, taking the bowl. "That's a good sign." "Hmm," he said, leaning down and adjusting his spectacles to inspect her notations. "Yes. It really was fascinating the way that shin vegetable caramelized. I'm so pleased that Gom brought it to me. You'll have to go over my notes. I think I got the figures right, but I could be wrong." He wasn't as strong at mathematics as he was at theory. Conveniently, Garanid was just the opposite. She took a spoon and tried the food. She didn't wear a sleeve on her safe hand. Another one of the advantages of being an Ardent. The food was actually quite good. "Did you try this, Ashir?" "Nope," he said, still looking over her figures. "You're the brave one, my dear." She sniffed. "It's terrible." "I can see that from how you're taking another large bite at this moment."
"Yes, but you'd hate it. No fruit. Is this fish you added?"
"A dried handful of the little minnows I caught outside this morning. Still don't know what species they are. Tasty, though."
He hesitated, then looked up at the hearth and its spren.
"Garanid? What is this?"
I think I've had a breakthrough, she said softly.
But the figures, he said, tapping the writing board. You said they were erratic, and they still are.
Yes, she said, narrowing her eyes at the flame spren. But I can predict when they will be erratic and when they won't be.
He looked at her, frowning.
The spren change when I measure them, Ashir, she said. Before I measure, they dance and vary in size, luminosity, and shape. But when I make a notation, they immediately freeze in their current state. Then they remain that way permanently, so far as I can tell.
What does it mean? He asked.
I'm hoping you'll be able to tell me. I have the figures. You've got the imagination, dear one.
He scratched at his beard, sitting back, and produced a bowl and spoon for himself. He'd sprinkled dried fruit over his portion. Garanid was half convinced he'd joined the Ardentia because of his sweet tooth.
What happens if you erase the figures? He asked.
The spren go back to being variable, she said. Length, shape, luminosity.
He took a bite of his mush.
Go into the other room.
What?
Just do it. Take your writing board.
She sighed, standing up, joints popping. Was she getting that old? Starlight, but they'd spent a long time out on this island. She walked to the other room where their cot was.
What now? She called. I'm going to measure the spren with your calipers, he called back. I'll take 3 measurements in a row. Only write down 1 of the figures I give you. Don't tell me which one you're writing down.
All right, she called back. The window was open, and she looked out over a darkening, glassy expanse of water. The Reshi Sea wasn't as shallow as the Pure Lake, but it was quite warm most of the time, dotted with tropical islands and the occasional monster of a great shell.
3 inches, 7/10, Ashir called.
She didn't write down the figure.
2 inches, 8/10.
She ignored the number this time, too, but got her chalk ready to write as quietly as possible the next numbers he called out.
2 inches, 3/10.
Wow.
What?
She called.
It stopped changing sizes. I assume you wrote down that 3rd number?
She frowned, walking back into their small living chamber. Ashir's hot plate sat on a low table to her right. After the Reshi style, there were no chairs, just cushions, and all the furniture was flat and long, rather than tall. She approached the hearth. One of the 2 flame spren danced about atop a log, shape changing and length flickering like the flames themselves. The other had taken on a far more stable shape. Its length no longer changed, though its form did slightly. It seemed locked, somehow. It almost looked like a little person as it danced over the fire. She reached up and erased her notation. It immediately began pulsing and changing erratically like the other one.
Wow, Ashir repeated. It's as if it knows, somehow, that it has been measured, as if merely defining its form traps it somehow.
Write down a number.
What number?
Any number, he said, but one that might be the size of a flame spren. She did so. Nothing happened.
You have to actually measure it, he said, tapping his spoon softly against the side of his bowl. No pretending.
I wonder at the precision of the instrument, she said. If I use one that is less precise, will that give the spren more flexibility? Or is there a threshold, an accuracy beyond which it finds itself bound?
She sat down, feeling daunted.
I need to research this more. Try it for luminosity, then compare that to my general equation of flame spren luminosity as compared to the fire they're drawn to dance around.
Ashir grimaced. That, my dear, sounds a lot like math.
Indeed.
Then I shall make you a snack to occupy you while you create new marvels of calculation and genius.
He smiled, kissing her forehead.
You just found something wonderful, he said more softly. I don't know what it means yet,
but it might very well change everything we understand about Spren, and maybe even about Fabrials.
She smiled, turning back to her equations. Then for once she didn't mind at all as he began chatting about his ingredients, working out a new formula for some sugary confection he was sure she'd love.
I-9. Death wears white. Zeth, Sun-Sun Bellano, Truthless of Shinovar, spun between the two guards as their eyes burned out. They slumped quietly to the floor. With three quick strokes, he slashed his sharp blade through the hinges and latch of the grand door. Then he took a deep breath, absorbing the stormlight from a pouch of gemstones at his waist. He burst alight with renewed power and kicked the door with the force of a light-enhanced foot. It flew backward into the room, hinges no longer holding it in place. Then it crashed to the floor, skidding on the stone. The large feast hall inside was filled with people, crackling hearths and clattering plates. The heavy door slid to a halt and the room grew quiet.
I am sorry, he thought.
Then he dashed in to start the slaughter. Chaos ensued. Screams, yells, panic. Zeth leaped atop the nearest dining table and started spinning, cutting down everyone nearby. As he did so, he made certain to listen to the sounds of the dying. He did not shut his ears to the screams. He did not ignore the wails of pain. He paid attention to each and every one. And hated himself. He moved forward, leaping from table to table, wielding his shard blade, a god of burning stormlight and death.
Armsmen! Yelled the light-eyed man at the edge of the room. Where are my armsmen?
Thick of waist and shoulder, the man had a square brown beard and a prominent nose. King Hanavanar of Yakaved. Not a shard-bearer, though some rumors said that he secretly kept a shard-blade. Near Zeth, men and women scrambled away, stumbling over one another. He dropped among them, his white clothing rippling. He cut through a man who was drawing his sword, but also sliced through three women who wanted only to escape. Eyes burned and bodies collapsed. Zeth reached behind himself, infusing the table he'd leaped from, then lashing it to the far wall with a basic lashing, the type that changed which direction was down. The large wooden table fell to the side, tumbling into people, causing more screams and more pain. Zeth found himself crying. His orders were simple. Kill. Kill as you have never killed before. Lay the innocents screaming at your feet and make the light eyes weep. Do so wearing white, so all know who you are. Zeth did not object. It was not his place. He was truthless. And he did as his masters demanded. Three light-eyed men got up the nerve to attack him, and Zeth raised his shard blade in salute. They screamed battle cries as they charged. He was silent. A flick of his wrist cut the blade from the first one's sword. The length of metal spun in the air as Zeth stepped between the other two, his blade swishing through their necks. They dropped in tandem, eyes shriveling. Zeth struck the first man from behind, ramming the blade through his back and out his chest. The man dropped forward, a hole in his shirt, but his skin unmarred. As he hit the floor, his severed sword blade clanged to the stones beside him. Another group came at Zeth from the side, and he drew stormlight into his hand and flung it in a full lashing across the floor at their feet. This was the lashing that bonded objects. When the men crossed it, their shoes stuck to the floor. They tripped and found their hands and bodies lashed to the floor as well. Zeth stepped through them mournfully, striking. The king edged away, as if to round the chamber and escape. Zeth sprayed a table's top with a full lashing, then infused the entire thing with a basic lashing as well, pointed at the doorway. The table flipped into the air and crashed against the exit, the side bearing the full lashing sticking it to the wall. People tried to pry it out of the way, but that only made them bunch up, as Zeth waded into them, shard blade sweeping. So many deaths. Why? What purpose did it fulfill? When he'd assaulted Alethkar 6 years before, he'd thought that had been a massacre. He hadn't known what a true massacre was. He reached the door and found himself standing over the bodies of some 30 people, his emotions caught up in the tempest of stormlight within him. He hated that stormlight suddenly, as much as he hated himself, as much as the cursed blade he held. And the king. Zeth spun on the man. Irrationally, his confused, broken mind blamed this man. Why had he called a feast on this night? Why couldn't he have retired early? Why had he invited so many people? Zeth charged at the king. He passed the dead, who lay twisted on the floor, burned-out eyes staring in lifeless accusation. The king cowered behind his high table. That high table shuddered, quivering oddly. Something was wrong. Instinctively, Zeth lashed himself to the ceiling. From his viewpoint, the room flipped, and the floor was now the ceiling. Two figures burst out from beneath the king's table. Two men in plate, carrying shard blades, swinging. Twisting in the air, Zeth evaded their swings, then lashed himself back to the floor, landing on the king's table just as the king summoned a shard blade. So the rumors were true. The king struck, but Zeth jumped backward, landing beyond the shard bearers. Outside, he could hear footfalls. Zeth glanced to see men pouring into the room. The newcomers carried distinctive diamond-shaped shields, half-shards. Zeth had heard of the new fabrials, capable of stopping a shard blade.
"You think I didn't know you were coming?" the king yelled at him. "After you killed three of my high princes? We're ready for you, assassin."
He lifted something from beneath the table. Another of those half-shard shields. They were made of metal embedded with a gemstone hidden at the back.
"You are a fool," Zeth said, stormlight leaking from his mouth.
"Why?" the king called. "You think I should run?"
"No," Zeth replied, meeting his eyes. "Because you set a trap for me during a feast, and now I can blame you for their deaths."
The soldiers fanned out through the room while the two fully armored shard bearers stepped toward him, blades out. The king smiled.
"So let it be," Zeth said, breathing deeply, sucking in the stormlight of the many gemstones tied in the pouches at his waist. The light began to rage within him, like a high storm in his chest, burning and screaming. He breathed in more than he'd ever held before, holding it until he was barely able to keep the stormlight from ripping him apart. Were those still tears in his eyes? Would that they could hide his crimes. He yanked the strap free at his waist, releasing his belt and the heavy spheres. Then he dropped his shard blade. His opponents froze in shock as his blade vanished to mist. Who would drop a shard blade in the middle of a battle? It defied reason. And so did Zeth. "You are a work of art, Zeth, son Naturo. A god." It was time to see. The soldiers and shard bearers charged. Mere heartbeats before they reached him, Zeth spun into motion, liquid tempest in his veins. He dodged between the initial sword strikes, spinning into the midst of the soldiers. Holding this much stormlight made it easier to infuse things. The light wanted out, and it pushed against his skin. In this state, the shard blade would only be a distraction. Zeth himself was the real weapon. He grabbed the arm of an attacking soldier. It took only an instant to infuse and lash him upward. The man cried out, falling into the air as Zeth ducked another sword thrust. He touched the attacker's leg, inhumanly lithe. With a look and a blink, he lashed that man to the ceiling as well. Soldiers cursed, slashing at him, their bulky half-shards suddenly becoming hindrances as Zeth moved among them, graceful as a sky eel, touching arms, legs, shoulders, sending a dozen, then two dozen men flying in all directions. Most went up, but he sent a barrage of them toward the approaching shard-bearers, who cried out as squirming bodies smashed into them. He jumped backward as a squad of soldiers came at him, lashing himself to the far wall and spinning into the air. The room changed orientations, and he landed on the wall, which was now down for him. He ran along it toward the king, who waited behind his shard-bearers.
"Kill him," the king said. "Storm you all? What are you doing? Kill him!"
Zeth leaped off the wall, lashing himself downward as he flipped, landing with one knee on the dining table. Silverware and plates clinked as he grabbed a dining knife and infused once, twice, three times. He used a triple basic lashing, pointing it in the direction of the king, then dropped it and lashed himself backward. He lurched away as one of the shardbearers struck, cutting the table in half. Zeth's released knife fell far more quickly than it should have, flashing toward the king. He barely got his shield up in time, eyes wide as the knife clanged against the metal.
Damnation, Zeth thought, lashing himself upward with a quarter of a basic lashing.
That didn't pull him upward, it just made him lighter. A quarter of his weight was now pulled upward instead of downward. In essence, he became half as heavy as he had been. He twisted, white clothing flapping gracefully as he dropped amid the common soldiers. Soldiers he'd lashed earlier began to fall from the high ceiling, their stormlight running out, a rain of broken bodies crashing one by one to the floor. Zeth came at the soldiers again. Some men fell as he sent others flying. Their expensive shields clanged to the stones, falling from dead or stunned fingers. Soldiers tried to reach him, but Zeth danced between them, using the ancient martial art of Kamar, which used only the hands. It was meant as a less deadly form of fighting, focused on grabbing enemies and using their weight against them, immobilizing them. It was also ideal when one wanted to touch and infuse someone. He was the storm. He was destruction. At his will, men flipped into the air, fell, and died. He swept outward, touching a table and lashing it upward with half a basic lashing. With half its mass pulled upward, half downward, it became weightless. Zeth sprayed it with a full lashing, then kicked it toward the soldiers. They stuck to it, their clothing and skin bonding to the wood. A shard blade hissed through the air beside him, and Zeth exhaled lightly, stormlight rising from his lips as he ducked out of the way. The two shardbearers attacked as bodies fell from above, but Zeth was too quick, too limber. The shardbearers didn't work together. They were accustomed to dominating a battlefield or dueling with a single enemy. Their powerful weapons made them sloppy. Zeth ran on light feet, held to the ground only half as much as other men. He easily leaped another swipe, lashing himself to the ceiling to give himself just a little more lift, before quarter-lashing him to make himself weighed down again. The result was an effortless leap of 10 feet into the air. The missed swing hit the ground and cut through the belt he'd dropped earlier, opening one of his large pouches. Spheres and bare gemstones sprayed across the floor. Some infused, some done. Zeth pulled stormlight from those that rolled close. Behind the shardbearers, the king himself approached, weapon ready. He should have tried to run. The two shardbearers swung their oversized blades at Zeth. He spun away from the attacks, reaching out and snatching a shield from the air as it tumbled toward the ground. The man who had been holding it crashed to the floor a second later. Zeth leaped at one of the shardbearers, a man in gold armor, deflecting his weapon with the shield and pushing past him. The other man, whose plate was red, swung too. Zeth caught the blade on his shield, which cracked, barely holding. Still pushing it against the blade, Zeth lashed himself behind the shardbearer while jumping forward. The move flipped Zeth up and over the man. Zeth went on, falling toward the far wall as the second wave of soldiers began to drop to the floor. One crashed into the shardbearer in red, making him stumble. Zeth hit the wall, landing against the stones. He was so full of stormlight, so much power, so much life, so much terrible, terrible destruction. Stone. It was sacred. He never thought about that anymore. How could anything be sacred to him now? As bodies crashed into the shardbearers, he knelt and placed his hand on a large stone in the wall before him, infusing it. He lashed it time and time again in the direction of the shardbearers. Once, twice, 10 times, 15 times. He kept pouring stormlight into it. It glowed brightly. Mortar cracked. Stone ground against stone. The red shardbearer turned just as the massive infused rock fell toward him, moving with 20 times the normal acceleration of a falling stone. It crashed into him, shattering his breastplate, spraying molten bits in all directions. The block hurled him across the room, crushing him against the far wall. He did not move. Zeth was nearly out of Stormlight now. He quarter-lashed himself to reduce his weight, then loped across the ground. Men were crushed, broken, dead around him. Spears rolled on the floor, and he drew in their Stormlight. The light streamed up, like the souls of those he had killed, infusing him. He began to run. The other Shardbearer stumbled backward, holding up his blade, stepping onto the wood of a shattered tabletop, the legs of which had broken free. The king finally realized his trap was failing. He started to flee.
10 heartbeats, Zeth thought. Return to me, you creation of damnation.
Zeth's heartbeats began to thump in his ears. He screamed, light bursting from his mouth like radiant smoke, and threw himself to the ground as the Shardbearer swung. Zeth lashed himself toward the far wall, skidding through the Shardbearer's legs. He immediately lashed himself upward. He soared into the air as the Shardbearer rounded on him again. But Zeth wasn't there. He lashed himself back downward, dropping behind the Shardbearer to land on the broken tabletop. He stooped and infused it. A man in shardplate might be protected from lashings, but the things he stood upon were not. Zeth lashed the plank upward with a multiple lashing. It lurched into the air, tossing aside the Shardbearer like a toy soldier. Zeth himself stayed atop the board, riding it upward in a rush of air. As it reached the lofty ceiling, he threw himself off, lashing himself downward once, twice, three times. The tabletop crashed to the ceiling. Zeth fell with incredible speed toward the Shardbearer, who lay dazed on his back. Zeth's blade formed in his fingers just as he hit, driving the weapon down through shardplate. The breastplate exploded, and the blade sank deeply through the man's chest and into the floor underneath. Zeth stood, pulling his sharp blade free. The fleeing king looked over his shoulder with a cry of disbelieving horror. Both of his Shardbearers had fallen in a matter of seconds. The last of the soldiers nervously moved in to protect his retreat. Zeth had stopped crying. It seemed like he couldn't cry any longer. He felt numb. His mind, it just couldn't think. He hated the king, hated him so badly. And it hurt, physically hurt him, how strong that irrational hatred was. Stormlight rising from him, he lashed himself toward the king. He fell, feet just above the ground, as if he were floating. His clothing rippled. To those guards still alive, he would seem to be gliding across the ground. He lashed himself downward at a slight angle and began to swing his blade as he reached the ranks of the soldiers. He ran through them as if he were moving down a steep slope. Swirling and spinning, he dropped a dozen men, graceful and terrible, drawing in more stormlight from spheres that had been scattered on the floor. Zeth reached the doorway, men with burning eyes falling to the ground behind him. Just outside, the king ran amid a final small group of guards. He turned and cried out as he saw Zeth, then threw up his half-shard shield. Zeth wove through the guards, then hit the shield twice, shattering it and forcing the king backward. The man tripped, dropping his blade. It puffed away to mist. Zeth leaped up and lashed himself downward with a double basic lashing. He hit atop the king, his increased weight breaking an arm and pinning the man to the ground. Zeth swept his blade through the surprised soldiers, who fell as their legs died beneath them. Finally, Zeth raised his blade over his head, looking down at the king.
"What are you?"
the man whispered, eyes watering with pain.
"Death," Zeth said,
then drove his blade point first through the man's face and into the rock below. Part 4. Storm's Illumination. Dalinar, Kaladin, Adolin, Navani. 52. A Highway to the Sun. I'm standing over the body of a brother. I'm weeping. Is that his blood or mine? What have we done? Dated Bevanev, 1173. 107 seconds pre-death. Subject, an out-of-work Vaden sailor.
Father, Adolin said, pacing in Dalinar's sitting room, this is insane.
That is appropriate, Dalinar replied dryly.
As it appears, I am as well.
I never claimed you were insane. Actually, Renara noted, I believe that you did.
Adolin glanced at his brother. Renarin stood beside the hearth, inspecting the new fabrial that had been installed there just a few days ago. The infused ruby, encased in a metal enclosure, glowed softly and gave off a comfortable heat. It was convenient, though it felt wrong to Adolin that no fire lay crackling there. The three were alone in Dalinar's sitting room, awaiting the advent of the day's high storm. It had been 1 week since Dalinar had informed his sons of his intention to step down as High Prince. Adolin's father sat in one of his large, high-backed chairs, hands laced before him, stoic. The war camps didn't know of his decision yet, bless the heralds, but he intended to make the announcement soon, perhaps at tonight's feast.
All right, fine, Adolin said. Perhaps I said it, but I didn't mean it. Or at least I didn't mean for it to have this effect on you.
We had this discussion a week ago, Adolin, Dalinar said softly.
Yes, and you promised to think over your decision.
I have. My resolve has not wavered.
Adolin continued to pace. Renarin stood up straight, watching him as he stalked past.
I'm a fool, Adolin thought. Of course this is what Father would do. I should have seen it. Look, Adolin said, just because you might have some problems doesn't mean you have to abdicate.
Adolin, our enemies will use my weakness against us. In fact, you believe that they are already doing so. If I don't give up the princedom now, matters could grow much worse than they are now.
But I don't want to be High Prince, Adolin complained. Not yet, at least.
Leadership is rarely about what we want, son. I think too few among the Alethi elite realize that fact.
And what will happen to you?
Adolin asked, pained. He stopped and looked toward his father. Dalinar was so firm, even sitting there, contemplating his own madness. Hands clasped before him, wearing a stiff blue uniform with a coat of Colin blue, silver hair dusting his temples. Those hands of his were thick and calloused, his expression determined. Dalinar made a decision and stuck to it, not wavering or debating. Mad or not, he was what Alethkar needed. And Adolin had, in his haste, done what no warrior on the battlefield had ever been able to do. Chop Dalinar Colin's legs out from under him and send him away in defeat.
Oh, Stormfather, Adolin thought, stomach twisting in pain. Ysereza, Kalek, and Ishi, heralds above. Let me find a way to write this, please.
I will return to Alethkar, Dalinar said. Though I hate to leave our army here down a shardbearer, could I? But no, I could not give them up.
Of course not,
Adolin said, aghast. A shardbearer giving up his shards? It almost never happened unless the bearer was too weak and sickly to use them. Dalinar nodded.
I have long worried that our homeland is in danger, now that every single shardbearer fights out here on the plains. Or perhaps this change of winds is a blessing. I will return to Kolinar and aid the Queen, make myself useful fighting against border incursions. Perhaps the Reshi and the Vaidens will be less likely to strike against us if they know that they'd be facing a full shardbearer.
That's possible,
Adolin said. But they could also escalate and start sending a shardbearer of their own on raids. That seemed to worry his father. Yakaved was the only other kingdom in Roshar that owned a substantial number of shards, nearly as many as Alethkar. There hadn't been a direct war between them in centuries. Alethkar had been too divided, and Yakaved was little better. But if the two kingdoms clashed in force, it would be a war the like of which hadn't been seen since the days of the Hierocracy. Distant thunder rumbled outside, and Adolin turned sharply toward Dalinar. His father remained in his chair, staring westward, away from the storm.
We will continue this discussion afterward, Dalinar said. For now, you two should tie my arms to the chair.
Adolin grimaced, but did as he was told without complaint. Dalinar blinked, looking around. He was on the battlement of a single-walled fortress. Crafted from large blocks of deep red stone, the wall was sheer and straight. It was built across a rift in the leeward side of a tall rock formation, overlooking an open plain of stone, like a wet leaf stuck across a crack in a boulder. These visions feel so real, Dalinar thought, glancing at the spear he held in his hand, and then down at his antiquated uniform, a cloth skirt and leather jerkin. It was hard to remember that he was really sitting in his chair, arms tied down. He couldn't feel the ropes or hear the high storm. He considered waiting out the vision, doing nothing. If this wasn't real, why should he participate? Yet he didn't completely believe, couldn't completely believe, that he was coming up with these delusions on his own. His decision to abdicate to Adolin was motivated by his doubts. Was he mad? Was he misinterpreting? At the very least, he could no longer trust himself. He didn't know what was real and what wasn't. In such a situation, a man should step down from his authority and sort things through. Either way, he felt he needed to live these visions, not ignore them. A desperate piece of him still hoped to come to a solution before he had to abdicate formally. He didn't let that piece gain too much control. A man had to do what was right. But Dalinar would give it this much. He would treat the vision as real while he was part of it. If there were secrets to be found here, only by playing along would he find them. He looked about him. What was he being shown this time, and why? The spearhead on his weapon was of good steel, though his cap appeared to be bronze. One of the six men with him on the wall wore a breastplate of bronze. Two others had poorly patched leather uniforms, sliced and re-sewn with wide stitches.